hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org and at iTunes. College Radio is how you can listen to us on iTunes. Today is Wednesday, November 7th, 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is, for the entire hour, is Hector Tobar. Before we bring him on, though, I want to tell all of you that we're in our second biannual fund drive. I guess that would be biannual, wouldn't it? Used to do this once a year. Now we do it twice a year because of university cuts and so on and so forth. We need to raise money to keep the lights on, to keep the water in the cooler, to keep our parking spaces. All of us are volunteers here and desperately need your help. As small a pledge as you can manage is fine with us. The phone number here is 949-824-5824. That's 949-UCI-KUCI. We have a wonderful DJ out there manning the phones, and lots of premiums to choose from, as well as I brought in some books, and he has a list of books that you can choose as part of your premium. So, yeah, we need your help. We're trying to meet a $10,000 goal, and, you know, it's difficult because everybody wants our money these days, but that's how this show stays on the air. Writers on Writing has been on for something like 14 years now. My son was very short when I started this show, and now he's taller than me. So it's been a while, and without KUCI, I am pretty much Writers on Writing wouldn't exist. I suppose we could go to podcasts, but wouldn't be the same as being on the air. And although we do podcast the show, it airs live every Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. around the world. I hear from you from everywhere. The outback of Australia, I think, is the most obscure place I've ever learned that a listener lives. So if you can, please give us a call. Get the phones busy because they're rather quiet right now. In any case, my guest today is Hector Tobar. He is a weekly columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a novelist. He's the author of Translation Nation and The Tattooed Soldier. He's the son of Guatemalan immigrants, a native of Los Angeles, where he lives with his wife and three children. And his most recent novel that we're going to talk about, that we're going to focus on, is called The Barbarian Nurseries, published by Picador. And this book got quite a bit of notice when it came out in hardback. The New York Times Book Review said, "Tobar exhibits a seismographic sensitivity to the tensions along the fault lines of his cultural terrain. His portraits, acute and humane, render his characters intelligible. His illuminations become our recognitions." Let's bring him on. Hi, Hector.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you on. Interestingly, your book came in from Picador before the West Hollywood Book Fair this past October, I guess it was. And I went to your panel. I think I booked you before the panel and went to the panel and found it so interesting what you were talking about in relation to the book in terms of cultural identity. And I wonder if you would begin by talking about The Barbarian Nurseries and what the genesis of the novel was.
Well, my novel originated, ironically enough, there on the campus of the University of California, Irvine, when I was an MFA student there, and I was doing my MFA in creative writing with the legendary Australian author, Thomas Keneally, mm-hmm. as one of my mentors. Mm-hmm. And I had just finished a draft of my first novel, and I was about to go out to agents, and I was thinking about what my second novel would be. And it was the beginning, this was many, many years ago, the beginning of the anti-illegal immigrant movement in California was starting to gain steam, and Proposition 187 was being put forth. And I wanted to write a novel about, you know, that particular moment in California history. You know, I'm a native Californian, someone who remembers the optimism and openness of our times of abundance in the 1960s and 70s, and to live through the austerity and the anger and the resentments of both, you know, at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, well, you know, that sort of really marked me as a writer, so I decided that I would write a response, an artistic response to living through this moment. And so The Barbarian Nurseries is the story of an immigrant woman who's charged with a crime. She's undocumented, as we learn about halfway through the book, and she works with this Orange County family that is very well off and also somewhat liberal, and so everything sort of blows up because of the family's financial problems.
Yeah, I particularly enjoy your sense of humor too. You are you're so funny, you know. I mean, you're just like, whereas other novels or stories that focus on Orange County often have a kind of I don't know, bitter, nasty undercurrent. Yours is rather funny and profound, actually.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. I, you know, I lived in Orange County for many years, and that sort of influenced the book. I lived there while I was a graduate student in Fullerton and commuted to Irvine and got to know the South Coast there pretty well. And, you know, I thought it was a beautiful place. And but at the same time, you know, you feel the incredible, you know, great social divide in Southern California when you go back and forth between Laguna Beach and Santa Ana, you know, or South Central Los Angeles. And, yeah, I mean, this is sort of a painful thing. It can be described as a painful thing. But you know, to me, at the same time, I've been shaped by sort of this California optimism. You know, I mean, Californians believe anything is possible. And so that sort of optimism and sort of faith in human nature and the belief that comes from having known lots of different kinds of people in California and knowing that they have more in common than they do, than the things that make them different, I think that really informs the sensibility of the novel and also just, you know, the kind of writing I've always liked, you know, that is humorous, that takes these serious political and cultural problems and finds the humanity and the humor in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. I mean, I have found that just during the last few months with the election and everything else, that it seems that people in California are a bit more, I don't know, do I want to say expansive in terms of, I don't know, culture and sort of the people we know, the people we spend time with, kind of multicultural aspect of the place is refreshing, especially when encountering people who may not live in such an expansive place.
Right, and that's sort of what my novel is about. My novel is about the way being in contact with different people changes you. And in my novel, Araceli is the protagonist. She's the housekeeper for Mexico City. And even though she's very, very strong-willed, very proud to be a Mexican woman, she has been shaped by her 4 years in the United States. She both admires the United States and is sort of repelled by some of the things that she sees. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also true for those of us and for the characters in the book who live with so many Latino people, people of Mexican descent. They, you know, see this this new population, this growing population. And in my novel, I'm very proud of the fact that there are all different kinds of Latinos across the broad spectrum of class, mm-hmm. In the Latino community, and also nationalities and outlook. And so, yeah, I think that has changed California. And, yeah, you know, at the same time that we have a greater sort of understanding of cultural diversity, there are things we don't know about each other, which is, of course, one of the main themes of my book, is that we accept this great divide between have and have nots in California, and we allow it even to exist in our own homes sometimes.
So true. Oy, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Hector Tobar. His book is The Barbarian Nurseries, published by Picador. We are in the middle of a fund drive. If you would so kindly call 949-UCI-KUCI, make a donation, however teensy, much appreciated. I think for $100, you can co-host Writers on Writing at the date of your choosing. So That's another wonderful premium that would be fun for you, especially those of you who've considered possibly hosting your own public affairs show, as this is. With Araceli, how do you pronounce her name again?
Araceli.
It's beautiful. And I found one scene early on especially poignant when she is, I think it's like, I have the book in front of me, 46, 45, 46, 47, when she's thinking about Mexico City, and she's thinking about just, you know, so many sensory details of how it was there in comparison with here. You do this with all of your characters, which is interesting. I mean, she is absolutely a sympathetic character, but so are your other characters, who may be the more entitled ones in the novel. Talk about that. Talk about, first of all, the aspect, the point of view aspect, where there are multiple points of views going on here, and then how you sort of divvied them up and decided sort of what place each would occupy, or did you? Or did it just sort of come out and you figured it all out later?
Well, I originally wrote this novel in a first version that was widely rejected. Well, it was rejected by every publisher in New York and beyond. And I wrote the novel originally from a single point of view, which was Araceli's. And it wasn't very successful, and I put it aside for many years. And then someone at a book festival had read my second book, Translation Nation, and my first novel, and told me, Hector, I think that one day someone's going to write a Bonfire of the Vanities set in Los Angeles, and that person is going to be you.
Mm.
And so that got me to thinking, and I read Bonfire of the Vanities, you know, that book has some wonderful observations about New York society, and really, really broad in scope, but satirical, you know, and somewhat mean and not entirely kind to its characters, not my personality, you know. I've been lucky enough to live across the class divide. You know, I'm from a working class immigrant family, and now I'm firmly ensconced in the upper middle class, you know, intelligentsia of, you know, Latino intelligentsia, such as it is, of Southern California. You know, I live well, and also when I lived in Latin America, I lived with full-time help in the home. I was a foreign correspondent for the Times, and so I know what it's like to both to be the son of a domestic and also to have a domestic in my home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that having lived across that class divide, which is something that a lot of people, you know, who live in California of our generation have gone through, you know, whether their families came from the Deep South or from the Midwest or from Korea, you know, a lot of us have had this chance to sort of travel across the class divide and arrive in this sort of, you know, promised land of the American middle class. And so having that experience makes me, I think, understand Araceli really well and her sort of attitude about the United States and about being an immigrant woman, and also it helps me understand the people that she works for, Maureen and Scott, who I made into one of these great hyphenates. We have so many hyphenates in the, you know, Los Angeles and California middle class. The family's called the Torres Thompsons. And Scott Torres is himself half Mexican, which makes his kids quarter Mexican, because he's married to a woman from Missouri. And so, Maureen. And so I really enjoyed becoming them. You know, I decided early on that I needed to become them to make them fully fleshed out characters, and it was fun to become Maureen, which, you know, took me many years to become this woman. In my novel, she is really sort of the strong presence at the center of the home. And she organizes her home as this work of beauty. She wants things to be pretty and orderly in her home, and she also has really strong progressive values. Ultimately, she's going to do things that end up almost bringing down her home. But you know, I know a lot of women and a lot of families like the families in my book, and it took me a while to realize that I could become them, and I'm really glad that I took that decision.
I'd love to hear you read from your book. Would you please?
Oh, sure. I wasn't quite 100% prepared for that, but I do have right here before me. I will just read to you the first, from the very opening of the novel, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. About how long would you like me to read?
Oh, three, 4 minutes.
Okay. I will read then here from the very beginning of my novel. It doesn't need an explanation since it is, of course, the opening of the novel. Scott Torres was upset because the lawnmower wouldn't start. Because no matter how hard he pulled at the cord, it didn't begin to roar. His exertions produced only a brief flutter of the engine, like the cough of a sick child, and then an extended silence filled by the buzzing of two dragonflies doing figure eights over the uncut St. Augustine grass. The lawn was precocious, ambitious, 8 inches tall, and for the moment it could entertain jungle dreams of one day shading the house from the sun. The blades would rise as long as he pulled at the cord and the lawnmower coughed. He gripped the cord's plastic handle, paused and leaned forward to gather breath and momentum and tried again. The lawnmower roared for an instant, spit a clump of grass from its jutting black mouth and stopped. Scott stepped back from the machine and gave it the angry everyman stare of fatherliness frustrated, of a handyman being unhandy. Araceli, his Mexican maid, watched him from the kitchen window, her hands covered with a white bubble skin of dishwater. She wondered if she should tell El Señor Scott the secret that made the lawnmower roar. When you turned a knob on the side of the engine, it made starting the machine as easy as pulling a loose thread from a sweater. She had seen Pepe play with this knob several times. But no, she decided to let El Señor Scott figure it out himself. Scott Torres had let Pepe and his chunky gardener's muscles go, and she would allow the struggle with the machine to be her boss's punishment. So that's the opening of my novel.
That's wonderful. If you just tuned in, you just listened to Hector Tobar read from The Barbarian Nurseries. Nice to hear you read, too, because it's always nice to hear a book in the author's actual voice. Did you read it aloud as you were writing it?
Sometimes I would, especially those opening passages. You know that the opening of the book is sort of your introduction to the editors, the prospective editors who are going to buy it, and so you want to really make sure you have that be something that establishes your voice. So yes, I think reading something out loud helps a lot, but just also, revision. Pretty soon it's sort of playing inside your head all the time. And so, yeah, definitely, I did do that sometimes.
Early on as well, Araceli has an observation of, just how the kids, how Maureen and Scott's kids are growing up with everything that they could possibly need. And there's a passage, if I had grown up with a mother like La Señora Maureen, the mental comparisons between Araceli's own austere childhood and the abundance that enveloped the Torres Thompson boys were inevitable when she entered this room. It was the only time in her workday Araceli felt self-pity and resentment at the absences and inequalities that were the core injustice of her existence. I found that so profound.
Oh, well, thank you. That comes from, I described this room that the boys have as the Room of a Thousand Wonders. Mm-hmm. From Araceli's perspective, she calls it the Room of a Thousand Wonders because they have everything you could possibly want, which is like hundreds of books and, solar systems floating from the ceiling of the room and, toys that make, Roman buildings and in Spanish it's El Cuarto de las Mil Maravillas, the Room of a Thousand Wonders. And so that came to me when I was sitting in my own son's room, my two boys who were little when I started this novel. And they just had everything they could possibly want, or at least the things that I gave them that I thought that they needed and would expand their minds. And my own sort of austere childhood came to me remembering that, and I could see how a character like Araceli would feel, in that environment, because Araceli really is someone who values learning and education herself. We learn in the novel very quickly that she is an art student. Who had to stop her own studies in Mexico City at the National University to go work and to send money home to her family, which I can tell you happens again and again to Mexican women, to Mexican working class women, to very smart, intelligent Mexican women. Mm-hmm. Happens all mm-hmm. the time. And so I gave that moment to Araceli, And, yeah, I was very proud of that because it reflects both an emotional truth and a social truth about Los Angeles and what happens in our homes, what people see, what people feel. You know, there have been several times in my life where I've had those kinds of encounters. I remember going off to college and my father driving me to college at UC Santa Cruz. And, you know, he was a man whose own education stopped in the sixth grade until he came to the United States and was able to go to night school and get his high school equivalency, but he never did go to college. And so when he dropped me off at college, I remember him looking around the room and my dorm room at UC Santa Cruz and seeing the forest outside my window, and he told me, if you're not happy here, you're not happy anywhere, you know, because yeah. That's what he wanted.
Right.
And so yeah, that moment I think is something that defines the city of LA really, and Southern California in many ways.
Hmm. Yeah, it sure does. And you know, down here, I don't know about other parts of the country, but you know, every day in every neighborhood, at least middle class to upper middle class to, you know, and on up neighborhood, you see Mexican women getting out of cars and going into houses, and you can't help but wonder what their lives are like and what they want, and do they want to, you know, go back to school, and can they, and why can't they, and, you know, the questions are endless.
Right, and the answers are really varied. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. there's, you know, I have one particular character who is sort of my alter ego. In many ways, but you know, there are also people who are sort of escaping, you know, a lot of family and dysfunction, or there are people who are just really incredibly ambitious, you know, and have made great sacrifices to follow their ambitions, and their ambitions go through cleaning the toilets at somebody's houses, you know, that sort of helps take care of their own family and personal ambitions, and it seems like a really thankless job, but when you know, compared to where you're coming from, that actually is a really great opportunity, you know, so it's, yeah, it's one of the great untold stories of our modern country, you know, the United States.
Yeah, sure is. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll have Hector Tobar with us a little longer, so stay with us. And again, we're in the middle of a fun drive. The phones are so quiet. Please make them ring, 949-824-5824. All donations are tax deductible, and there are premiums and all kinds of stuff that you can receive in exchange for your donations. So again, 949-UCI-KUCI, and we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
Darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
You've ever thought about making a donation to KUCI, now is the time. Non-commercial, free-form music and community programming is crucial to the radio landscape and to the community as a whole. My name is Hillary Chambers. I was a student at UC Irvine in the early 90s and worked at KUCI for 3 years. Started out as a trainee, worked my way up to music director, and since graduation I've worked in commercial radio, everywhere from KNAC in Long Beach to 91X and 94.9 in San Diego. And I'll tell you what, I've never had a radio experience like I had at KUCI. What I learned about radio and life in general played a huge role in getting me to where I am today. KUCI is an incredible resource for the students and the community members who are a part of it and the listeners as well. You don't need me to tell you that. Pledge now, KUCI.org, or call KUCI 949-824-KUCI, and thank you.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. I continue to be Barbara DeMarco Barrett. It still is Wednesday, November 7th, 2012, and Hector Tobar is still on the line. Let's bring him back on. I had a question about the Barbarian Nurseries in terms of structure, and that is, it turns into quite a suspenseful story. And I am curious whether you knew that from the start as well. Did you have any sort of outline going, or did you plot it out and you knew where you were going with this?
Well, you know, I decided early on that really what I was doing was I was writing three books, and I was sort of really worried because they're three very different books in one book, and different styles and concerns, and my question was, would the readers and the critics sort of stick with me, you know? And I, you know, I knew the originally when I had written my first version of this novel, I really had a lot of political sort of, you know, things that I was trying to do and show, and that's why it failed. So I realized that I had to do, I had to sort of understand this family that I was writing about. And so the first book I was writing in these three books that make one book was more of a domestic sort of portrait of an American family and the Mexican presence within this family in different ways. There's a Mexican presence in this family. There's a Mexican relative, and there's also, of course, this Mexican housekeeper who lives in the home. So that first book is the first section of the book, which I call The Succulent Garden. And, you know, my models on that were, you know, Chekhov and Cheever and Alice Munro and all the, you know, people who write about, you know, the soul of the, you know, North American and European family, you know, especially the middle class family. And then the second book I wanted to write was this journey into Los Angeles, where Araceli is left alone with the kids, and she has to take the children into this journey in L.A. to the heart of South Central Los Angeles. And I knew I wanted to make that really sort of fantastic, you know, something like a little. It's a little bit like Don Quixote is the idea behind it, because the little boy in the house reads too much. He's kind of isolated. He's really well off, and he's just read. He's a really precocious reader. And he interprets everything in the world that he sees when he gets into Los Angeles, into South L.A., especially through the lens of these crazy novels he's read, these young adult novels that he's read. And then finally, I wanted to work my way up to this last part of the book in which the whole, in which all of the divisions in the city and the great media machine would all sort of come into play, a little bit like Bonfire of the Vanities. And so that all comes together in the last part of the novel. So I knew that I was working my way to this to this part where the children would set off on an adventure, and then there would be recriminations because of the adventure they had gone on. And so that, I think that from early on, that was the basic structure of the novel. So yeah, and I'm really grateful that so many readers have taken that journey and followed me all the way to the end.
Yeah. Well, aside from everything else, your writing is just exquisite, really. I mean, there's a lesson here for writers in terms of coming up with original similes and metaphors. I mean, you know, there's so much going on with this book, but I love some of these. I started underlining them as I started reading, and then I just gave up because there were too many. But I want to read just one if I can find it. And in the meantime, I'll say you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am with Hector Tobar with the Barbarian Nurseries. Early on, I can't find it now, but it had to do with a prologue of, you describe like a hallway or a foyer as being a prologue to the house.
Oh, yes, yes.
And
it's where they walk into the guests are walking into the home, and it's this beautiful, room, and the guests pass through the impeccable prologue of the living room.
Yes.
Thence through an open sliding glass door to the backyard, a semicircle of grass the size of a basketball court framed by the restrained jungle of La Petite Rainforest. And so on. Yes, that was my description there.
That is just so cool. And then there was one. He was a tall, bulky man with curly chestnut blonde hair and much darker eyebrows that were shaped like railroad boxcars. Now he raised both boxcars spryly as he made eye contact with the Mexican maid. I love that. And I want you to talk about this, idea of metaphor and simile, and coming up with original metaphors and similes, because this is one of the hardest things I think writers encounter in creative writing.
No, well, thank you for pointing that out. That was really something that I told myself I had to do to be successful. I think my biggest hero in this regard, in terms of just prose and metaphor and simile, because she always comes up with the most original ones, is Susan Orlean.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't write fiction, of course,
mm-hmm.
but especially in The Orchid Thief, she had just absolutely some killer similes and metaphors. And so I really took that to heart. And, Günter Grass also has many in The Tin Drum, another one of my heroes. And they're also very comic. And I think I learned from both of them and from many other writers that descriptions need to have movement in them,
mm-hmm.
And that was something that I always gave myself as a challenge. I told myself, you're always afraid of being rejected as a writer, and you know that rejection is the sort of default. People get your manuscript, and the easiest thing to do is say next, So you have to give them reasons not to say no, and if you can have a killer, unique, original description, or simile or metaphor, on every other page, if not every page, then it makes it harder for people to say no to you and to put you down, because they put down your manuscript, because they can see that they're in the presence of someone who takes the craft seriously and is trying to exercise it at the highest levels, And so that's what I aspired to, and I worked really, really, really hard, at that. I remember at the beginning when I undertook this novel, I knew that I was going to have many, many Latino characters, and I knew I had to come up with many synonyms for the word brown, because I couldn't say everyone was brown-skinned, So my goal was never to use the word brown in the novel. I didn't quite succeed in that, but I did have some nice descriptions of, I remember Araceli, her skin color is the color of a newly minted penny,
mm-hmm.
Which I arrived at by looking at myself in the mirror one day and thinking, yes, that's the color of my skin,
huh.
A newly minted penny. And so,
but how long did you have to look in the mirror to see that? How long do you spend until that perfect simile comes to you?
Oh, usually it's not very long at all, because, and oftentimes it's when you're not thinking about it. There's
mm-hmm.
a certain part, you have to be relaxed, I think that relaxation is undervalued in writing, because it's it's both concentration and relaxation. You know, you're so totally into something that suddenly you sort of step back from it for a second, and then it comes to you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say, yeah, there are times that writing can be really torturous, but, you know, I'm sort of trying to channel, it's channeling two kinds of mental work. There's the mental work of constructing something, and it can be sort of tedious and, you know, repetitive. And then there's the mental work of play, you know, which you have to have be part of your work process too. You know, they have to remember that you're playing. You're doing it because you love it and because it's something that, you know, you want to be able to show that you can do some fireworks every once in a while. And that just involves being really, you know, happy with what you're doing and relaxed with it, you know.
Hmm. What's the crossover from journalism? Because you have quite a hefty background in journalism. What did you bring from that into your fiction?
Oh, well, just many, many, many things. I mean, first of all, just the work habit of never, ever allowing yourself to have writer's block, because if you have writer's block as a journalist, you're going to get fired, you know? And that's one thing. And the other thing is just learning the power of observation and learning the absolute joy that comes with going to a place and seeing something new. So with my first novel and with this novel, I often did little research trips that would involve me driving around Los Angeles or walking around Los Angeles. When I lived in Orange County, I would often take the train from our home in Fullerton to downtown Los Angeles, and I would just observe and take notes, and I would look for the similes and metaphors. You know, I remember my first novel, The Tattooed Soldier, staying in their freeway underpass and seeing the vines creeping along the bottom of the freeway underpass and thinking that looked like, you know, like veins, you know, like a system of arteries, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the light, you know, so I think that when you go to some place, you're going to see something that is going to delight you and interest you, and that's going to give you something you can work with artistically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you learn that habit. For example, there's a passage in one of the last things I wrote for the Barbarian Nurseries was about this moment of quiet and silence, and I had to fill this moment of silence, and I realized that I could have all these bird calls, because when it's quiet in LA, you know, you hear lots of birds. So I knew that I was in Huntington Park on the 4th of July in the morning. What kind of birds would I, you know, hear? And so I called up the leading bird expert in Los Angeles County, Kimball Garrett, at the L.A. County Museum of Natural History. And within a couple of hours, he had sent me a list taken from his draft of the L.A. County Bird Atlas of the birds you would find in Southgate and Huntington Park. What kind of birds pass through there, because there are people who go and do a census of the birds, you know. And so he gave me a list, and from that list I chose several, and I was able to do these riffs. You know, there's a woodpecker that stores its food inside telephone poles, you know, and I just that is too precious as a writer. When you get those kinds of details, you have to, you know, you really try to work and find a place for them. And so that is something I learned from journalism, was the, you know, that you can interact with your surroundings and find out more about them and find beautiful things to write about in your surroundings.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, earlier you said something to the effect that, and I believe you were talking about the Barbarian Nurseries, that an early draft failed because you were trying to tell about politics, insert politics into the book instead of having it sort of evolve from the story?
Yeah, the characters were at the service of the themes of the story,
mm-hmm.
rather than the themes naturally arising from the characters, you know. And so that was, you know, my antagonists, Maureen and Scott, were cardboard cutout characters. And part of that is because, you know, they were parents, their parents in the novel. And when I wrote my first draft of the novel, I finished it on the day that my wife went into labor with our first son.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't really become a parent yet, and then I sent it off quickly a year later to my, well, a year is nothing in book publishing, but a year later I sent it off to my agent, and it really, you know, I really hadn't been a parent yet. And when I went back to writing the novel in 2005, I had been a parent already for, my oldest son was about 11 or so, no, 9, excuse me, and And when it was finally published in 2011 in hardcover by FSG, my son went to my first reading, the same son who was born on the day that I finished the first draft, and he was then 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that time, I had learned a lot about family, and I realized that what I really had to say was what it was like to be an American parent, you know, is a lot of what that book's about, what it's like to be an American father, an American mother in this time that we're living in, when you have a little bit of help and you have all these expectations for your kids and all these challenges and you live in this crazy city. So that's, you know, what the book became about. It was more about my lived experience in the end and the lived experience of the city that I reside in, and less about the point that I was trying to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, and I'm also curious, what made you return to the book? How did you know that this had to go through more iterations until it was going to be done? I mean, do you do that with all of your projects, or are there projects that you do let go because they just don't carry enough weight, or they just, you know, you forget about them and so you don't return?
Well, I think generally speaking, one of the most important things you can do as a writer is to set aside your work for a certain amount of time, you know, whether it's a week or a couple of years.
In
this case, it was 4 or 5 years that I set it aside, because time is a gift as a writer, because it gives you fresh eyes and you see your own work in the context of all the reading you've done. You know, so I went back to read my novel and that I had the first draft, and I had seen how flawed it was. But it's not something, no. I had actually given up writing fiction. I thought I would never write fiction again after my second novel was rejected by everyone, and I gave up on it. And I thought, you know, my second book was a nonfiction book, Translation Nation. But what happened was when I came to the United States, because I was living in Argentina, back to the United States for the book tour for Translation Nation, I met lots of people who had read my first novel, The Tattooed Soldier, and lots of really young readers especially, because The Tattooed Soldier, my first novel, is now in its 13th or 14th printing because it's been assigned so widely in universities. It's a real popular book, especially in California universities. I met these young readers, and they, you know, had really responded to my novel, and I thought, you know, maybe I should write another one for them. Maybe I am a novelist. And that's when I went back and looked at my old novel with fresh eyes and realized how flawed it was, how deeply flawed it was, and how I had not really become the writer that I needed to be. And so I spent the next 5-6 years becoming that writer, teaching myself to be a true novelist.
Why did you think after Translation Diaries that you couldn't write fiction again?
Well, you know, my second novel had been widely rejected, and no one had bought it, and you know, there's nothing. I mean, every writer, now I know, I think every writer has at least one. Every successful writer has at least one really great failure, you know, in their on their hard drive, mm-hmm. or in their desk or in their file cabinet. But I just, you know, I come from a family I just never really thought that I was an artist, you know, that I could be an artist. And I think, you know, a novel is a work of art. It's a work of imagination, of creativity, above all. And I just didn't really believe that I had earned the right to call myself that. I was joking recently because I was in Paris. My novel, The Barbarian Nurseries, was translated into French, and I was in Paris, and I was on a panel with Russell Banks, who was talking about how he knew he was an artist from the time he was 19, and I joked. I said, well, Russell, that's really great that you knew you were an artist when you were 19, because I didn't realize I was an artist until, like, day before yesterday, when I arrived in Paris, and all the Parisians started saying that I was an artist. So I figured, if I'm in Paris and they're calling me an artist, I must be an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's... It's just a personal sort of struggle. I think that's something that's very, when I speak a lot to Latino groups, especially to, you know, the children of immigrants, I tell them, you know, if you're intellectual, embrace it. If you believe that you came to this world to create, embrace it, because you can be that.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's this practical streak that runs through Latino culture that says you really shouldn't waste your time doing those kinds of things.
Sure, sure. We are almost at the end of our time. I've been with Hector Tobar. His book is The Barbarian Nurseries, and our phone is silent out there, so the number, if you care to donate before the show is over, is 949-824-5824. Were there points in this book that you just felt stuck or lost or all written out? And if so, how did you get through it? Do you like put it aside and let it sit a little longer? Do you pick up a novel,
right,
a book that's inspiring and read your way out of it, or just what?
Well, I think I think patience is really important. All those things. I mean, there are times when you set something aside and you read another novel and you get really excited by being in the presence of a great prose writer, definitely. That happened to me several times. I was really sort of not stuck, but a little worried at the end there about my prosecutor character, for example. And there's a prosecutor at the end of the novel who's one of the obvious heavies of the book. And that he was hard to write because I didn't want him to be the cliched bad guy prosecutor. And I think it's just being patient and having faith in yourself as a writer. A lot of times what a lot of writers do, and I know I'm not alone in this, is you go back and you read something in your own work that you know is good, that pleases you, or even in a book you've written before sometimes, and then you sort of say, okay, I can do this, and you have to have faith in your ability to overcome the obstacles before you.
Yeah. Well, it's been just a delight talking with you. I absolutely love this book and really hope that our listeners pick it up and read it for so many different reasons. And so appreciate your time here.
No, well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That was Hector Tobar. His book, again, is The Barbarian Nurseries. It's in paperback, trade paperback, so you can pick it up at lower cost than a hardcover. You can find it probably at a library. Really just wonderful. I can't say enough about it. Love this sort of novel, where it deals with politics. It deals with various points of views coming from different economic backgrounds and nationalities and persuasions. It's really just excellent. We have a little bit of time left, so I'm gonna talk up the fund drive a little longer, because we so need funds to keep the station going, to keep the lights on, and anything at all will help us. You can donate online at kuci.org. You can see a list of premiums there. I have a list of books that I will send to listeners of the show if you want to donate, and you'd rather have a book than a CD or dinner tickets or t-shirt or whatever. And you can email me at penonfire@earthlink.net. Those books are not on the KUCI website, but I'd be happy to send you one. So let me know. And hope you're all doing well out there. Hope the election pleased you. And if not pleased you, at least that you're finding some satisfaction in how things turned out in your own neighborhood with propositions and senators and Congress and all sorts of things that were decided last night and continue to be decided. Thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM in Irvine. I'll see you here next week.